loud and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm Brian Becker, and I'm joined in studio by co-host John Kiriakou. In our first hour, we take a look at two major stories. First, we have an in-depth discussion with the world-renowned correspondent, journalist, and author Ahmed Rashid about the war in Afghanistan, the political evolution of the Taliban, and the prospects for peace in Afghanistan. And then we continue our weekly series called False Prophets. We do this every Tuesday. False Prophets is a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey.
But before we get to those stories, we'll go over today's headlines, including stories that we'll cover in depth in the second hour. First, a journalists group, Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, has filed a federal motion asking that all documents related to a pending indictment of Julian Assange in the Eastern District of Virginia be unsealed. Federal prosecutors oppose the motion and say that a recent leak that seemed to indicate that a secret indictment already exists was inadvertent and should not be construed as confirmation. Judge Leonie Brinkema, who reserves all national security cases for herself, will make a decision. Next, The Guardian is reporting today that Paul Manafort held secret meetings with Julian Assange in the Ecuadorian embassy in London in 2013, 2015, and 2016. Manafort calls the report 100% false, and WikiLeaks said there is literally nothing true about it. Meanwhile, the special counsel's office says that Manafort has violated the terms of his plea deal by continually lying to investigators, and he should be sentenced immediately. Then Nikki Haley, the U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, accused Russia on Monday of taking outlaw actions against Ukrainian ships in an incident at sea this weekend and vowed that sanctions punishing Russia's annexation of Crimea would continue. Haley said, quote, "Outlaw actions like this one continue to make an improvement in U.S.-Russian relations impossible. The United States will maintain its Crimea-related sanctions against Russia. Indeed, further Russian escalation of this kind will only make matters worse," unquote. Donald Trump's comments, however, struck a different tone from Haley's. And finally, the Mississippi Senate race will be decided in a runoff election today that pits former Congressman and Agriculture Secretary Mike Espy against incumbent Republican Senator Cindy Hyde-Smith. Hyde-Smith has found herself at the center of controversy recently over her previous support of Confederate symbols and monuments. Espy is the strongest possible Democrat to challenge Hyde-Smith, but polls show that the Republicans will keep the seat. And in other headlines, French President Emmanuel Macron began to give ground to the mass movement that has erupted in the country against fuel taxes. Huge militant protests have been met with police repression, deepening the unpopularity of Macron's government. Today, he proposed setting up a mechanism where every 3 months the tax is reviewed and subject to revision based on prevailing prices. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu's office today announced that Israel and Chad will soon establish formal diplomatic relations. The president of Chad, Idriss Deby, was in Israel today, the first visit by a Chadian head of state since the country broke diplomatic ties with Israel in 1972. Deby is a close ally of Western governments, and this move is expected to be unpopular among the Chadian public. Former FBI Director James Comey commented on acting Attorney General Whitaker today, speaking to a Boston radio station. Comey said, referring to Whitaker, quote, "He may not be the sharpest knife in the drawer, but he can see his future and knows that if he acted in an extra-legal way, he would go down in history for the wrong reasons," unquote. Since being fired early in the Trump administration, Comey has joined the growing ranks of former intelligence and law enforcement officials who have become vocal opponents of the Trump administration. An Afghan summit in Geneva started today with the goal of improving the war-torn country's economy and development. 17 years of war have devastated wide swaths of Afghanistan. Those are today's headlines. You're listening to Loud and Clear.
Loud and Clear.
Now we turn to our conversation with Ahmed Rashid. More than 17 years after U.S. troops entered Afghanistan and overthrew the Taliban, that country is still in a state of disarray. In just the past 48 hours, at least 20 Afghan police officers were killed in a Taliban ambush. A U.S. Special Forces officer was killed. 3 American soldiers were killed in a bomb blast. And the Afghan government announced that it may delay the upcoming presidential elections. We spoke yesterday with Ahmed Rashid, who joined us from Madrid. He is a journalist and the best-selling author of Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan, and Afghanistan, and several books on Afghanistan and Central Asia, including The Resurgence of Central Asia, Islam, or Nationalism. Ahmed Rashid was also the author of the book Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. That book was published in 2000, just prior to the September 11th, 2001 attacks. Ahmed Rashid, welcome to Loud and Clear.
Thank you.
Thank you for joining. I have to say, at the time of the September 11th attacks in 2001, I was living in New York, and I had actually, I think, just purchased your book. It came out about the Taliban right around the time of the attack. When you look back at the past 17 years and the fact that this war in Afghanistan continues and all that's happened to Pakistan in between and the other peoples and countries of the region, what's your big takeaway?
Well, it's been very depressing, quite frankly. And I think a lot of the advice that was offered to the Americans when they first came into Afghanistan, especially on reconstruction, rehabilitation, bringing the refugees back from Iran, Pakistan, and other countries. People like myself and a few handful of American specialists on Afghanistan tried to give the Bush administration a proper direction. And unfortunately, they did not take that advice. Of course, the biggest mistake was that they went into Iraq. And by doing so, they took away the best American troops, forces from Afghanistan to Iraq. And those troops never returned until another 7-8 years later when President Obama sent in troops. But more than the presence of troops, there was not a political settlement with the Taliban, which at least in the first 2 years after 9/11 was eminently possible because the Taliban were a defeated, shattered force. And there were some diehards left who were having shelter in Pakistan, but they too could have been approached. And eventually, Pakistan became so untrustworthy of the Americans that Pakistan helped relaunch the Taliban in 2003, 2004. And really, that was the start of the war. And Pakistan feared, of course, that the Americans were going to abandon Afghanistan. They were going to get bogged down in Iraq. They wanted continued American aid. And they said, well, one reason that aid will continue would be through reviving the Taliban. And, of course, that suited a lot of other people, too, drug smugglers, regional powers, and some of the tribes inside Afghanistan. So really, the chance for reconstruction, rehabilitation, political accommodation, compromise was between 2001 and 2004. And that opportunity was never taken up.
Ahmed Rashid is our guest. I mean, that's amazing, Mr. Rashid. Your point, and I want to explore it a little bit more for our audience, especially for Americans here who, after 17 years, people are really not paying attention to Afghanistan. There's not a lot of American soldiers dying there. It's kind of, from an American media point of view, treated as a low-intensity conflict. But you're saying that the Taliban immediately shattered and defeated, or almost immediately after the October 7th, 2001 invasion by the United States and its allied forces, then the Bush administration turns its attention to the invasion of Iraq, again using the war on terror now as basically a slogan or a banner for doing whatever, including invading Iraq, even though Iraq had nothing to do with September 11th. And during that time, your point is that the Taliban, having been shattered, fundamentally shattered, if not completely, could have been brought into some sort of an agreement by the United States, that there were enough forces remaining within the Taliban would have accepted that, and that the U.S. did not do that. Why would the U.S. not have done that? Was it because there was sort of a sense that they were down and out, no need to negotiate with them?
Well, I think there were many reasons, but certainly one of the reasons was that the American forces were very undereducated on who the Taliban were exactly. The Taliban were never part of a pan-national terrorist organization like Al-Qaeda. They gave hospitality to bin Laden, but they never took part in any of his attacks. And so, you know, they were very much part of Afghanistan, part of the fabric of Afghanistan. And when the agreement in Bonn at the end of the war, and there was an agreement in Bonn with all the countries and the UN, mediated by the UN, and all the Afghan factions were there, and they formed a new government which was headed by President Hamid Karzai. That new government and that negotiation did not include the Taliban. Now, even at that point in time, when the Taliban had just been defeated, there were already overtures being made by some Taliban leaders to the Americans and to the Pakistanis and to the Afghan government that we want to surrender. As long as you don't send us to Guantanamo and you treat us, you know, reasonably, we will surrender and lay down our arms. Now, unfortunately, by then what had happened was Guantanamo had been set up primarily for Al-Qaeda. But suddenly Guantanamo began to take in every Tom, Dick, and Harry who was caught, whether he was Taliban or a drug smuggler or a petty thief or whatever. And hundreds of people ended up in Guantanamo. And that became the symbol of the American presence in Afghanistan, rather than the idea that, you know, all Afghans who were not directly involved with bin Laden and Al-Qaeda could be part of a settlement. And unfortunately, this attitude to the Taliban extended then into their ethnic bias, because most Taliban were Pashtuns. That is the largest ethnic group in Afghanistan. And by making the Taliban an enemy, they made the entire Pashtun ethnic group, about nearly 50% of the country, into a potential enemy. And so the Taliban had no problem recruiting Pashtuns to fight the Americans, because the Americans were shoving everyone that they found even vaguely guilty to Guantanamo. So there was a lot of anger amongst the Pashtuns. And rather than receive some of these figures who wanted to surrender formally and lay down their arms, unfortunately, the Americans were by now, after a year or so, seeing every Pashtun as a potential enemy. And that really laid the seeds for this conflict, which has just escalated ever since.
We're talking to journalist and correspondent author Ahmed Rashid. He's a best-selling author of Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan, and several books on Afghanistan and Central Asia, including The Resurgence of Central Asia, Islam or Nationalism, Taliban, another book he wrote, Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. These are must-read books for our audience that wants to understand what happened in Afghanistan and what continues to happen. Maybe we could entitle this a segment, Ahmed, A Road Not Taken, because what you're suggesting is that this war that has gone on and is called by in American media as America's longest war, as if it's not an ongoing and more terrible war for the people in Afghanistan, there could have been a different way. Help, because you did the book on the Taliban, which was, as I said in the beginning, I read that book right after, I believe, the September 11th attacks in 2001. Talk about who the Taliban were, how you came to do your own research and understanding of the Taliban movement, and what the difference is now between the Taliban, the resurgent Taliban that was brought back to life, you said, by Pakistan after or around 2004, and the original Taliban.
Well, the Taliban today are very different from the Taliban that I was dealing with and meeting with and living with literally since 1993. I mean, they emerged actually as a kind of religious movement to do away with the warlords who had instigated this terrible civil war after the Soviets had withdrawn from Afghanistan. And that civil war continued right through the 90s, and the Taliban then became an agent for reconquering Afghanistan, as it were, and instead of trying to bring peace, they became one more warlord. And eventually, by 9/11, they had control of most of Afghanistan, except for a small pocket in the north. Now, I had been covering the Afghan war right since the Soviet invasion. I was, in fact, in Kandahar when the Soviets invaded in 1979. And I spent a long time covering the war, both from the Mujahideen side, the Afghan fighter side, and from the Soviet troops and from the communist side. And then, of course, you know, there was a breakdown in 92 with the collapse of the Soviet Union and the collapse of the communist government, and then the civil war started. And then, you know, you started hearing about this mysterious group of young men in the south, in Kandahar, Pashtuns, who had started a movement to cleanse the country of warlords and drug addiction. And I went down there to see them, and I was really quite stunned, because these young Taliban were really a second generation. They had nothing to do with the fight against the Soviets. They were too young to have taken part in that war. Some of the leaders had taken part, but most of them hadn't. They were very young. They were coming straight out of madrasas. These are religious schools in Pakistan, some set up in Afghanistan. They had spent their lives as refugees, many of them, in Pakistan, and then they'd gone to these religious schools. And they were very naive in many ways. Many of them had never been to Afghanistan before, because they had spent their entire life in refugee camps in Pakistan. You know, others came from very obscure areas of Afghanistan where there was no electricity, there was no education, there were no jobs. They were sort of poverty stricken. And we were, it was a very strange bunch of people, but they were very successful in cleansing a lot of the warlords from the south, and the movement took off, and they started getting hundreds of Pashtun recruits from Pakistan and from the rest of Afghanistan, and they developed an army, capturing a lot of the weapons that the communists had left behind, etc. I met these young men, and they were extremely shy. They would not allow you to photograph them. They would hardly give you an interview. It was very difficult getting close to them. And then, of course, they had this kind of very weird, at least for a lot of ordinary Muslims, a very weird interpretation of Islam, which was very hard line. They believed in a very strict enforcement against women working or being educated. They had their own legal system, courts of justice, in which the death penalty was very common. And they inspired both hope and terror at the same time. And it's this combination of hope and terror that allowed them to take on the other warlords, eventually capturing Kabul in 96 and then moving north to deal with the other ethnic groups in Afghanistan who were very anti-Taliban. So what I saw, I was certainly with them until 9/11 and even after 9/11, they barely tolerated me. Whether I wanted interviews, I wanted to take their pictures. I went in with a couple of TV crews. They refused to allow TV crews to make a documentary about them. It was very difficult dealing with them. They were basically against journalists and against outsiders who came in. But one thing, you know, we saw that bin Laden came back to Afghanistan in 96-97 and asked for sanctuary from the Taliban. And the Taliban gave him sanctuary with the premise that he would not carry out acts of terrorism from Afghan soil. And, you know, that is well recorded. And they were very conscious of the fact that they didn't want bin Laden's reputation to precede him. But unfortunately, you know, what bin Laden did was that he bought in a lot of money, and he took control of part of the drugs trade and started funding the Taliban, the movement, who, and they were always very short of money. The Taliban became kind of addicted to this and obliged to bin Laden for the benefits that he was giving them, which included training the Taliban troops in all this kind of suicide attacks and things like that. And there was an element in the Taliban that became very fanatical and became very much pro bin Laden and his idea of global jihad and all the rest of it. And so there was a rift in the Taliban, basically, between the hardliners and people who wanted to get rid of bin Laden. And what happened in 9/11 that, you know, it was, I think it took most of the Taliban by surprise. They were not expecting bin Laden to carry out, and they certainly didn't have Taliban permission to carry out the attack on New York and Washington. And the Taliban were left kind of, in a very helpless situation. And Mullah Omar, was besotted with the Pashtun idea of hospitality, that once we have given a guest a room in our house, then we can't get rid of him. So as the Americans tried to push the Taliban to get rid of bin Laden or to hand him over to the Americans, Mullah Omar refused. Although there were many moderate Taliban at that time who were more than willing to give bin Laden over. So what and then, of course, subsequently, the Taliban became, if you like, much more aggressive. And once the war restarted in 2003, bin Laden and Al-Qaeda and other groups started helping the Taliban. And you had a very different generation of leaders coming forward. Taliban who were no longer young, but were very inspired by bin Laden and by the idea of global jihad and defeat. You know, having defeated the Soviets, they said, okay, well, now we'll defeat the Americans. And so, you know, I've been through like three generations of Taliban, and we're probably into a fourth generation now who might be willing to negotiate a peace settlement.
Yeah, that's what I was wondering. Ahmed Rashid is our guest. He is a internationally recognized correspondent, journalist, author. He is the author of Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil and Fundamentalism in Central Asia, and several other books, including Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan. Ahmed, let's talk about today. I mean, the Taliban have not been defeated. The armed resistance groups to the United States and its allies have not been defeated. At the same time, they don't appear to be able to secure an all-out military victory. I mean, wars end either because one side loses and the other side wins, or both sides exhaust each other, or there's a negotiated settlement or a combination of those things. Given the way the battle is going, and it appears that the Taliban is able to inflict more and more casualties on the Afghan government side and to some extent on Americans, do you think there is a sense within the Taliban current leadership that now is a time to negotiate, or do they feel the war is going in their advantage and thus why bother?
Well, you know, as I said earlier, there's always been a moderate lobby in the Taliban who consider themselves as Afghan patriots, who want foreign forces, whether Soviets or Americans, out of their country, but are not prepared to do global jihad or anything like that. And I think there's an intense debate going on right now because the Americans have offered to hold peace talks with the Taliban. I think the debate within the Taliban has intensified between those who see this continuing war as being useless, much better have a settlement, share power with the Kabul government, etc. And of course, then there are hardliners who are saying we're winning, and you know, I mean, we're killing 50, which is true. They're killing between 30 and 50 Afghan soldiers, police, special forces a day, a week. The casualties which the Afghan government is facing are absolutely horrendous. So these Taliban are saying, well, we should fight it out till victory. Why should we compromise and sit with these treacherous people in Kabul? We can conquer Kabul. We can conquer the cities. Now, I don't think they can conquer the cities as long as the Americans are there in some form or shape and moreover give give the Afghan army air cover, which is the most important thing that the Americans do. But there are a few American troops there. It's about 12,000, about 3,000-4,000 from NATO countries. That's certainly not enough to mount an offensive, and they are there mainly for training the Afghans. But the Afghans are taking such terrible casualties from the Taliban that I think there is an enormous sense of despair, and the fact that the Kabul government and their American allies are not winning this war. The American mantra these days is that there's a stalemate. I would say that there's much more than a stalemate. I would say that the Taliban are winning. They don't control any major city, but they control the roads. They can block off food supplies and traffic at any given moment. They have attempted to take cities in the last 2 years. But basically, their main aim is to kill as many Afghan soldiers as possible to shatter morale in the Afghan army. And that is where we are really seeing Taliban success, because how long is this army going to hold together when it's facing such horrendous casualties?
Ahmed Rashid is our guest. He's a journalist, best-selling author. He's talking to us from Madrid. We're talking about Afghanistan. Ahmed, and we have about two and a half minutes left. You made the point that Pakistan revived the Taliban and brought it back as a force, as a military force, around 2004 after it had been shattered, and that Pakistan had its own interests, its own reasons. What about Pakistan's view now? Of course, the Trump administration is trashing the Pakistan government almost daily. How does Pakistan see the Afghan conflict right now?
Well, I think, you know, broadly speaking, Pakistan wants a peace settlement now, and they would like to see the war come to an end, because this war has led to acute terrorist attacks inside Pakistan by groups which are called the Pakistani Taliban. In other words, the Afghan Taliban have spawned a whole new generation of Pakistani terrorists who are trying to topple the government in Pakistan. There's a much greater awareness now of the dangers of supporting the Taliban. But at the same time, Pakistan wants a settlement which is entirely in its favor. They want a government in Kabul which is not pro-India. Remember, India is the black sheep for Pakistanis, because Pakistan has fought three wars against India, and Pakistan does not want. India is already a neighbor on the eastern side of the country. They don't want an Indian government or pro-Indian government in Kabul, which would put Pakistan into a pincer movement, into a pincer, as it were. So they are very and of course the Trump administration is very pally with India right now. In fact, India is one of their few friends in the entire region. If you look at it, I mean, the Trump are trying to make peace, but Iran, Pakistan, Russia are all anti-American. And this is going to make any peace process very difficult, because you need to bring in all these countries into a peace process. And yet the Americans don't have a relationship with a lot of these countries. So India is very important to the Americans. And as long as there's not some obvious deal in which the Indians are prepared to restrict or limit their presence in Afghanistan to the satisfaction of the Pakistanis, you're going to see continued India-Pakistan conflict and continued Afghan government and Pakistan tensions, and of course the Americans getting more and more frustrated, because it's absolutely clear now that the Trump administration want to get out of Afghanistan as fast as possible. Remember when Trump was running for president, he said the first thing he'd do would be to pull all forces out of Afghanistan. When he came into office, he was persuaded by the U.S. military that, you know, the U.S. can't face a pullout, because it would lead to a defeat like Vietnam. And we can't have another catastrophic defeat of the Afghan forces, which, especially by this sort of ragtag Taliban, it would be a disgrace. So We have now the hope that there can be a settlement, but there are a lot of factors involved.
We're going to leave it right there. We were joined from Madrid by Ahmed Rashid. Mr. Rashid is a journalist, best-selling author of Pakistan on the Brink, The Future of America, Pakistan and Afghanistan. He's written several books on Afghanistan and Central Asia, including The Resurgence of Central Asia, Islam or Nationalism. He's also written Taliban, Militant Islam, Oil, and Fundamentalism in Central Asia. I encourage our audience to get his books to learn more about the Afghan war and about the region. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm Brian Becker.
And I'm John Kiriakou.
Today we continue our weekly series. It's every Tuesday called False Prophets, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with Daniel Sankey. We're joined from San Francisco by Daniel Sankey. He is a financial policy analyst. Daniel, there's a lot to talk about this week. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me, Brian.
Okay. Donald Trump is not happy. Because GM, which he has been pointing to, that everything is recovering because of his sagacious leadership and his sagacious economic policies. And anyway, we should actually say what the word sagacious means. It means wise. He's not happy, but more importantly, thousands and thousands of working families are not happy because General Motors has announced that rather than going forward in this great new economic boon, they are slashing thousands of jobs and closing factories throughout the United States. What's this story?
Yeah, so they are slashing around 15,000 jobs, which is a huge number of jobs, and closing some historic plants that have been operating for decades. And it shows a really fundamental change to General Motors. What they're talking about is the reason why they're doing this is to start moving into the self-driving car and electric car industry, which is, you know, not going away and is growing and is really challenging their business model, which has been to, produce automobiles for American consumers. Typically, they were riding high on the big SUV boom, which I don't know if you guys remember that. That wasn't so very long ago that was a huge attractive boom to buy these very large outsized cars for, you know, single families. And really, that started changing significantly. The technology in the industry is changing. And people are much more appealed to electric cars, which now have a lot more power and durability than they used to. They also save you a ton of money on account of the fact you don't need to buy as much gas. And then, of course, the self-driving car, which, you know, you talk about slashing 15,000 jobs. The self-driving car will slash even more. And you can see GM is poised to try to move into that industry. So really, they are pivoting and they are changing the type of business that they're doing. They're still in automobiles, of course, but this is going to change how they're going to do it. What that means is getting rid of huge parts of their industry that they used to be in, and along with that, the nearly 15,000 jobs. Trump, of course, has been on the road to success largely by talking about restoring manufacturing jobs, restoring the Rust Belt, and improving the economy. And certainly the economic figures of the last few months have shown a low unemployment rate, and which he touts as, you know, due to his, you know, brilliant economic talent. But, you know, what we're seeing here is the particularities of the system, which is that there are boom and bust cycles. There are, once you have flooded a market with automobiles, you need to move into other markets, in this case, electric cars and self-driving cars. And the human fallout from that, which is to lose 15,000 jobs. So GM is here to make money. They're here to profit as absolutely much as possible. And even in a favorable economic environment, or at least what he's portraying as a favorable economic environment, I kind of question that, they are going to go after the highest rate of profitability. And that means eliminating a lot of jobs, so then they don't have to pay those payrolls, and moving into more automated technologies, which will further, you know, eliminate other jobs in other industries. So that's what we're seeing here, and this is kind of a natural outgrowth of it. Companies aren't going to pass jobs out because the economy is good, because they feel some kind of kinship to the people they employ. They're going to do it to be profitable. And in spite of a good economy, it's not as profitable to keep these plants open and to keep this business model running as it is to move to a new business model and different sorts of technologies. And the result is 15,000 jobs lost.
And is it your gut, Daniel, that these 15,000 jobs are mostly because of automation or mostly because the economy is beginning to slow? And they're salary jobs, too, by the way.
They're salary jobs, which means that they're not the union. They're not union jobs. They're not people on the assembly line.
So that seems to me that it would mean this is an efficiency exercise.
There is a lot of that. I mean, GM has been under a lot of pressure to become profitable, to produce more profitability. It has, been struggling a little bit in the stock market. And this is a sign that it's saying, hey, we are revamping our business line. We are taking bold steps. So we're calming investor fears, right? And as we enter this new kind of unstable economy that we've been plowing into in the last month or so, this is a sign to its investors that we're making large, long-term sweeping changes. I don't think it's a response just to immediate economic indicators. I think that this sort of major change is something that's going to be a lot more thought out and thought through, and it's going to have repercussions over the next decades in the future. So it's not a short-term thing to deal with kind of an immediate economic need. It is them saying we are pivoting and changing our overall business model, and these jobs are no longer necessary.
You know, it says a lot about power in society. Here you have the president of the United States, the CEO of the state apparatus. He wants to be able to take credit for returning jobs and manufacturing to the United States. He's a powerful person. But General Motors and the General Motors Board of Directors and their constituency, which are their investors and mainly their biggest investors, they're making the decision. They don't have to listen to the president. They don't have to listen to Congress. They don't have to certainly listen to the workers, salaried or wage workers. They don't have to listen to the communities that gave them tax rebates to set up shop there. They make their own decisions. It is, I would say, and I'm saying this, of course, as a socialist, but just, let's look if this is not objectively true. This is the tyranny of capital. They get to make the decisions about whether we working people work. We get to vote every 2 or 4 years, but they make the decisions about whether these jobs exist or not because the jobs belong to them. It's a matter of deed. It's a matter of legal ownership. It seems to me to be a fundamental problem, and no politician, no matter how powerful under the existing system, can just demand, insist, or order them to keep these jobs and these factories open.
Exactly. I mean, I think that's really what's fundamentally important to see here is they're saying Trump's mad and he's angry and he's drawing his ire or whatever as different newspapers have reported. So he can tweet and he can yell loudly and he can go before the news media and say how terrible GM is and I'm going to do something about it. But the truth is that GM is going to make its decisions without Trump entirely and that there's really virtually nothing Trump can do about it. And I mean, that's capitalism, right? It's not state ownership. It's not ownership of the people. It is ownership by private individuals, of which GM is, composed of. So their wealthiest, largest investors, a small cabal, have decided that they're going to make this pivot so that over the next, decades to come, GM will remain competitive and will be part of this self-driving and electric car industry.
When they made this announcement, of course, again, this is going to be devastating to these communities. We're talking, we're talking about Youngstown, Ohio. We're talking about Detroit. We're talking in Canada, in the province of Ontario near Toronto. Possibly the plants in Baltimore, Maryland, and suburban Detroit community of Warren, Michigan, which right now have not been slated to close, but their contracts are not being renewed for 2019. All of these places, people are going to be going, oh my God, I can't believe it. Especially like if you're an older worker. You might have been there for a long time. Your family's dependent on it. Maybe you have kids in college. Suddenly, like GM pulls the rug out from under you. But guess what, Daniel? Shares of GM stocks went up. They went up a lot. They went up 7.8%. And that's investors investing in GM stocks after the announcement of this devastating cuts.
Yeah, well, not just GM. So GM did go 7.8 up, and that's because the investors are happy that they're laying off all these people because they know, if anything, in the short term, there will be a boost to profitability because these payrolls won't be paid out, more than that's highly likely. But they also believe in the longer vision. But that's not it, only thing. Ford and Chrysler also rose, although not to the degree that GM did, but they also went up. And why is that? That's because investors know that the way these auto manufacturers work is one of them starts making bold moves and moving into a different industry, the other ones are going to start thinking the same way, and they don't want to be left out in the cold. So what Ford and Chrysler are saying is, GM, which is, you know, a very talented company from an auto manufacturing perspective. It knows something. Maybe we should know something too. Maybe we should also make some bold moves in this industry, because right now it might not be a problem, but in 5 years, 10 years, GM might completely blow us out of the water and take over this industry. So what that means is there's a likelihood that we'll see similar actions by Ford and Chrysler as they consider pivoting into this industry as well, even more as a way to kind of confront GM's competitiveness. So that's why you see this general raise. Investors like the layoffs, right? They like the saving of money. They like bold moves. They're clearly signaling that they think electric and self-driving cars are the way to go. And they're rewarding General Motors for laying people off and moving into these industries by investing more money with them and pushing up their share price.
You know, 70, 80 years ago, there were 300 auto companies. Now there's three. The same process of monopoly concentration of production and of economic power. The small fish are eaten by the big fish. The big fish are eaten by even bigger fish. You're down to really monopoly pricing. You don't see any real massive fluctuation in car prices between the auto companies. It feels like all of these prices are established in sync with each other. In other words, the so-called free market actually doesn't exist here.
Well, the free market has a contradiction in it that can't be resolved. And that is, if you're going to have efficiencies, lower prices, faster production, more innovation, you're going to need a lot of competition. You're going to need those 300 companies or whatever. But the problem is that competition, by definition, has to create winners and losers. Winners have to get bigger. They have to eat the losers' markets, and then the losers vanish. And then the winners go back into the field to fight again, but this time a little bigger than the other ones. And the process repeats itself. So in 70, 80 years, inevitably, you must have monopoly, because how else could you not have monopoly? The whole purpose of competition is to take your competitor's market. And if you remove that incentive to somehow slow monopoly growth, well, that would just, you know, de-incentivize the whole process. So the creation of monopoly power over the quote-unquote free market is inevitable, given how the system works. It's a contradiction that can never be resolved so long as we have this, you know, free market economy.
Finally on this, before we go to another story, if we think back to the 2007-2008 recession, we're going to talk in our next stories, John, about the possibility of more recession or a new recession.
Yep, and we've said repeatedly, you know it's coming, because that's the nature of our system.
Yeah. So we're going to talk about that. But just before we leave the issue of auto, when the U.S. automakers, the big three, but let's talk about Ford and GM, were essentially bankrupt during the great recessionary financial meltdown of 2007-2008, the U.S. government came in and bailed them out. But what it also did is, as part of the bailout, insisted on the rewriting, that is the scrapping of existing contracts, collective bargaining agreements, which are contracts. You know, we know about the sacrosanct contract, the commercial contract, the business contract is the, you know, the law of the land. And yet when the U.S. government came in to bail them out, they said, well, you have to renegotiate the contracts. And the workers in the United Auto Workers Union, now desperate because they thought their entire industry was going to go completely down and they'd have no jobs, they were compelled by the U.S. government to rewrite the contracts to create a lower wage, a second tier and a third tier of low wage workers who are taking jobs in auto all over the country. Auto jobs that used to be like premium, high paying, decent paying, livable wages, and driving them down. So here we have a situation too, where the government, when it did bail out industry, bailed it out in a way that was good for the bosses. I mean, maybe the workers will argue, of course, that it was good for workers if, in the sense that the plant stayed open. But a lot of workers, tens of thousands of workers, took a very, very big pay cut, and it very much weakened the United Auto Workers Union going forward.
Well, and I think look at that dynamic, because when the government bailed out the auto manufacturers, what did they bail them out with? You know, they bailed them out with the money that the workers had given them through their taxes. So they took the workers' money, they gave it to the bosses, and then they told the workers they couldn't have the same contracts. So what benefit were they paying into these taxes? Was there some kind of public good that they were getting from giving the government, you know, millions and millions of dollars in taxes? No, absolutely not. And moreover, they were already bailing out the companies anyway. They were already giving them all this money for free. Why punish the workers? Why push down on them? Well, the idea was, of course, they wanted to ensure that these auto manufacturers were profitable. And the best way to get profitable is to grind down those wages, to rip up those contracts. And 2008 was this very unique political and economic crisis. And normally that sort of negotiation would have been unacceptable to unions, would have been fought back against. But in the midst of this economic meltdown, they saw an opportunity. And that opportunity was to get rid of these contracts that people had been fighting for decades and struggling to get so that they could take political advantage of the time. And I'm sure the auto manufacturers loved it. I'm sure they were extremely happy that not only did they get the bailout money, they get to tear up these union contracts that had hurt their profitability for so long.
Daniel Sankey is our guest. Daniel is a financial policy analyst. We talk to Daniel every Tuesday in this segment about the economy and the big economic issues. Let's move on to another story. I'm looking at a headline from the New York Times yesterday. It's an opinion piece by William D. Cohen. Mr. Cohen is a former investment banker and the author of four books about Wall Street. Here's the headline. I'll just start with the headline and let you go with it, Daniel. When blue chip companies pile on debt, it's time to worry. Subtitle, fueled by cheap credit, American corporations have been gorging on acquisitions. The party may soon be over. Ominous. Let's talk about what is a blue chip company. Why were they taking on debt? Why was it cheap credit? Why have they been gorging on acquisitions? Why is that helpful to them? And why is the party maybe almost over?
Yeah. So let's talk. Blue chip companies really are just companies that our listeners will recognize as these huge, decades old, sometimes even longer, centuries old companies that have been part of the American landscape forever. So General Electric, AT&T, Sherwin-Williams, Campbell Soup, all these brand names that we've heard of and grown up with, right? So a blue chip company are these large, well-established companies, and they're really used as kind of bellwethers for the economy. If they're doing well, then the economy is doing well. If they're not doing well, then the economy is doing poorly. Because of their monopoly influence, because they have so many fingers and so many different pies, they influence so much, that's why they're used as these kind of bellwether predictors. What it's talking about is that a ton of these companies have taken on tons of debt. So we're talking $2.5 trillion of United States corporate debt. That's a huge amount of money. And what have they done with this debt and why? So they got this debt because the United States dropped interest rates to zero in the 2008 crisis. And that was a way to try to make money as cheap as possible. Why would they do that? They would do that because the hope was that corporations would borrow a lot of money at very low interest rates, near zero interest rates, and then use that money to stimulate the economy, right? Open up factories, make more jobs, et cetera. This sounds very much like what Trump is trying to say. If we keep things tax rates cheap for the corporations, they'll take their extra money and give it to workers because, you know, they want more jobs. That was the thinking. Well, what these companies did is they didn't hire more workers because that wasn't nearly as profitable as doing something else. What that something else was is they took the money and they started buying other companies. They started merging with them. So different companies bought out other ones and grew in size and grew in monopoly power. This is a great way to boost profitability. Investors really like it. And overnight, you can acquire these large markets just by these very large deals. And investors are usually on both sides of the transaction. So the ones that own the company that's getting bought are getting some of the money from the buyout. Then the ones on the other side of the transaction who are doing the buying are growing their market share and they're becoming profitable this way. Normally, this wouldn't have been possible because where's all this money coming from to make all these purchases? Well, it's coming from these near zero interest rates, the fact that they can just borrow the money, buy a company, and pay it back later at really low interest rates, which is what we're seeing. The reason why they're saying the party's soon be over is a couple of things. This isn't real economic growth. This is borrowing, right? So I can take a cash advance out of my credit card and I have, let's say, $5,000 extra and I can go spend extravagantly and have a real wild, you know, weekend or something. But at the end of the day, then all I'm left with is debt and interest, and I'm going to have to pay back way more than $5,000. And so while I lived high on the hog and luxuriously, it was kind of an illusion. It wasn't real money. That's what's happening here is the debt's coming due, and they're coming to have to pay it back. But the economy is new now. It's not 2008. And the Fed has continually been raising interest rates. The economy has been continuing to slow down. And now they're trying to restructure this debt. They're trying to get it into better interest rates, and they can't because the interest rates have been raised from zero, which is the only way to go. You can't have negative interest rates, well, except in extreme circumstances. But the point I'm trying to get at is now they can't get those favorable borrowing terms like they had before. Now they're getting real interest rates. Now the party's soon to be over because they can't borrow like they used to. The money's running out. the payments are coming due, and their kind of fake profitability that was based off of these loans is starting to become more and more visible. When that happens for these really big blue chip companies, that impacts the economy in a really broad, broad way, because they have so much influence over the economy. And that's what we're seeing here with those blue chip companies starting to, their payments starting to come due.
It's easy to make predictions about a coming recession because eventually you will be right under capitalism. I mean, there are other economies that don't actually experience recessions, but it seems as if the entire global economy is slowing right now. And because the entire world economy is so integrated, you see Chinese steel companies are slowing. They're producing less right now. That means there are fewer workers because China's steel is being integrated in and purchased on the world market, not simply a Chinese market. Everything is profoundly, profoundly interconnected. You know, the thing that I would like to just spend another minute on before we go to the next story, which is about, we want to talk about what's going on in the housing market, because that's 1/6 of the entire U.S. economy. But again, going back to this concept of corporations acquiring other corporations. So what that means is the companies buy another company. They can't really afford the other company. So they take out debt. They take out huge loans, and then they buy the other company, and then they lay off a whole lot of workers, both from their existing company and the other company, because now the two operations are combined and some of those working positions will be considered redundant labor. So they make some extra profit by squeezing out labor, essentially, by squeezing out labor. At the same time, we have the process of monopolization, monopoly, concentration of wealth. I was reading a story a little while ago, Daniel. 8 families in the world are so oligarchic in character that they have the combined wealth equal to 50% of the population of the world. Now, the population of the world, I don't know what it is exactly. Maybe it's 7.6 billion. So we're talking about, what, 3.8 billion people have the combined wealth equal to 8 families. And those 8 families obviously are not working. I mean, they're not doing real work, but they own these corporations that are concentrating this kind of wealth. And neoliberal capitalist economic policy isn't really, it doesn't seem to be about generating wealth per se. It seems like really extracting wealth from some part of the population and giving it to another part. And the other part is the part that's already fabulously rich. Do you see it that way?
Yeah. So I have firsthand experience, actually, when you talk about companies buying each other and during the 2008 crisis and laying off workers. I worked for Wells Fargo, which purchased Wachovia, as I'm sure some of our listeners are aware of. So Wachovia doesn't exist. It became Wells. And that was due to the 2008 crisis because Wachovia was collapsing. It was imploding. And the Fed allowed Wells to purchase Wachovia for really good prices with really good terms. So it did. I worked in an office in California. We had a sister office that was doing the same work I was in Nevada. Well, then we purchased Wachovia and we got yet another much bigger office in North Carolina. So we had 3 offices doing the same work: North Carolina, Nevada, and California. Well, I'm sure your listeners can imagine which state had the highest salary pay, and that was California. So they looked at these 3 areas. They said, well, we just bought Wachovia. We don't need all 3. Who should we get rid of? And surprise, surprise, of course, California was the office that was laid off. So I lost my job that way. And it wasn't even because Wells Fargo was doing badly. As far as the banks went, it fared pretty well in the 2008 crisis. It's because it was doing so well. It bought another company that it was doing so well, and that caused me to lose my job. So, you know, when the corporations lose, you lose. When they win, you lose, which is exactly what I experienced. That's part of that monopoly power. 2 years, a year and a half before the 2008 crisis, Wells Fargo was freaked out by Wachovia. We were having these meetings when they were talking about, oh, Wachovia is going to try to eat our lunch. They're moving into the West Coast, to the Western states. We got to be ready for them. They're real tough. They're not going to take any prisoners. And then what do you know? A couple of years later, we own them. And now we own this huge market. So Wells Fargo was big before, but man, it is big now. Those 6 families, where do you think they keep that incredible wealth? Well, they keep it at banks like Wells Fargo and others. And so Wells Fargo gets access to that capital and can deploy it in all kinds of different ways, different investments, different loans, financial instruments we can only conceive of. So the banks partake in that monopoly power, and that influences hundreds of thousands, millions of lives. It certainly did mine when I lost my job for the first time and had to frantically look around. But anyway.
That's financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. We talk to him from San Francisco every Tuesday about the big economic issues of the week. John Curiaco, housing constitutes 1/6 of the U.S. market. And
enormous.
It triggered the last recession, or it was certainly a triggering feature of it. It looks, too, that the housing boom might be coming to an end. The Wall Street Journal says the U.S. housing boom is coming to an end, and its end is starting in Dallas, Texas. Home prices zoomed higher in recent years, and mortgage rates are climbing. Buyers are queasy. Yeah, housing.
You know, this is only anecdotal, but I think it's worth mentioning. I have a friend who's a very successful real estate agent in one of the suburban counties here in Northern Virginia. And she was the one who told me in 2008, when housing prices just stalled out in early 2008, she said the recession's here. And it was weeks before the media began reporting on what became the Great Recession. She told me on Thanksgiving Day that exactly the same thing has happened, that housing prices in this very affluent suburban county have just flatlined. And she said it's going to happen again, like right now. The recession's here. And like I said earlier, Brian, we all knew it was coming. You've been talking about this for ages because it's the nature of our capitalist system. But now we have to prepare for more layoffs and higher unemployment, and times are going to get tough again.
Go ahead, Daniel, and let's talk a little bit about this Dallas piece as well, if we could.
Absolutely. So the Dallas piece, Dallas is this, economic powerhouse. It's had a real big boom, attracting lots of jobs, growing a lot in the economy, kind of a success story. But the article is talking about how the housing market there is not reflecting it. The housing market is slowing and stalling. Prices are dropping. It talks about real estate agents having to go through these extravagant means to try to attract buyers by giving them Super Bowl tickets or trying to, romance them with Louis Vuitton luggage or things like that. The point being is that we are seeing a slowing in the housing market. We've seen these sky high prices, which has resulted in massive homelessness and gentrification throughout the U.S. And this can only go on so far. The prices can only stay as inflated as they are, and there can only be real buyers for so long. And what we're seeing is those buyers are running out, those people that can afford these really overpriced homes. This is largely due to the fact that housing in the United States is a speculative investment. It's a way for hedge funds and equity firms to speculate on the price of housing. And of course, so long as they're buying houses, they want the prices to go up, right? They're going to do everything they can to keep them up by artificially inflating prices till they're beyond what's reasonable. They're going to use credit. They're going to use investments, et cetera. But eventually that runs out, because the truth is people don't really have that much money to afford them. They have to take out big loans. They have to use complex financial instruments to afford them. And so what we're seeing now is that inevitably tumbling down. When you speculate on things, when you artificially inflate prices, you have to watch them artificially fall. At some point, it will actually fall. In the end, what it means is, because houses are for speculating in and not living in, everybody, the workers get hurt, right? People who need houses to live in with roofs over their head are the ones who get hurt. And that's what we're going to start seeing, because ultimately they didn't want to speculate on their house. They didn't want to gamble on it. They just wanted a place to raise their family that they could, call home and be part of a community. The speculation on that, though, makes trying to profit off of these homes primary over the need to live in them. And we're going to see more and more of the likes of Dallas throughout the United States, I think.
Yeah. 10 years ago, 9 million families went into foreclosure, not because of something they did. They couldn't pay their mortgage. 3 million of them were actually lost their home. And then you had companies like Blackstone buying up all these foreclosed properties, keeping them off the market, and then selling them later at higher prices. Again, it's the concentration of wealth, where even terrible, devastating crises actually constitute an opportunity for some parts of the population, a very, very narrow part of the population that has access to capital, the tyranny of capital. Anyway, we're completely out of time. This weekly segment every Tuesday called False Profits, a weekly look at Wall Street and corporate capitalism with financial policy analyst Daniel Sankey. You're listening to Loud and Clear. Stay with us.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR, Community Public Radio. .org. I'm your host, Don DeBar.